tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. Just before he died, a German soldier wrote to his pastor, "In Stalingrad," he said, "to put the question of God's existence means to deny it." I want to read the rest of the letter this young German soldier wrote in the closing days of his life, over in the battle in the fierce Russian winter in the city of Stalingrad in the latter part of World War II. He went on to this pastor of his in a church back in Germany, "I must tell you this, I have searched for God in every crater, in every destroyed house, on every corner, in every friend, in my foxhole, and in the sky. God did not show himself, even though my heart cried for him." He went on, and I will quote, "The houses were destroyed, the men as brave or as cowardly as myself. On earth, there was hunger and murder. From the sky came bombs and fire, only God was not there. And if there should be a God," he went on, "he is only with you, in the hymnals and the prayers, in the pious sayings of the priests and the pastors, in the ringing of the bells and the fragrance of incense, but he is not in Stalingrad." End of quotation. From the captured mail of a German soldier who never returned from that war, who revealed his last thoughts in a private letter to his pastor in a church in Germany. This some years ago in the waning months of 1942, during one of the most bloody and terrible battles in the wars of man, was certainly the idea in the minds of many other soldiers on both sides of the battle, and it has been the idea in the minds of countless thousands of others in Europe and even in the Western Hemisphere and in many nations. Now, a noted atheist once wrote, "If there is a God, why didn't he give man in the ages past the knowledge so necessary to his existence? And this man did not know that the proof that God exists is available, that there is a God, that God does exist, that you can prove it and demonstrate it, and that that God did give man the very knowledge he needs that is necessary to his existence. But this man has cut himself off, and so he said, why didn't man receive the knowledge that he needed so vital to his existence, which he has so painfully acquired over the centuries, and which has proved so beneficial to him?" And then he went on to reason, and I want to give you a few excerpts from it. He said, and maybe some of you have wondered, he said, "Think of the myriad millions who have died in agony, but whose lives could have been saved, and whose sufferings could have been avoided if man possessed the knowledge we have today to cure the diseases which man has already conquered." Now, I'm going to question that a little bit, but of course we know what he meant. "Of what value," he said, "is the knowledge acquired today to those who have perished in the past? If I had the power," he went on, "to fashion the universe and to remake it nearer to my heart's desire," he said, "there would be no blind and no deaf, no dumb, there would be no crippled, and each child born would live free of disease," and so on. He said, "there would be no death by accident." Well, what? Would this man create a universe, and would he put a creation in that universe where there existed no laws? Because, you see, diseases, blindness and deafness and accidents, cyclones, hurricanes and tornadoes and wars are the result of broken laws. Would there be no laws? Would there be no laws of physics, chemistry, energy? Would there be no law of gravity and inertia? Could there be no accident? Is that the kind of universe this man would have created? Well, let's wait just a moment for the answer. There is going to be a utopia. There is going to be a world where accidents will not be occurring, where there will be no blindness, no deafness, no sickness, no dumbness, no crippling accidents. But it's not coming in the way most of us would like to believe. Now, here is the clipping that is really important. What if a little child begins to doubt God? You know, most children will voice disbelief or doubt or skepticism once in a while. So here parents are advised in a clipping that appeared recently in a major magazine here in the United States on how to handle the question. If God is so good, a child might pose, why does he allow so much evil in the world? Or he might ask it like this. Well, Daddy, why did God let Aunt Martha die? When you're trying to explain in vague generalities about the death of a loved one, an aunt, a grandparent, or someone, why did God let Aunt Martha die, the child might ask. She never hurt anybody.
However it's worded, this article went on in answer, this is one of the hardest questions in all theology. And so the writer said this, I would tell the child this, there are mysteries we don't understand. We do know that God gives us strength to live through these things we find so difficult. I don't believe, this man, and a noted religionist at that, that God's existence actually can be proved, and I'd make this plain to the child. Well, my friends, I've got good news for you now, and that is that God's existence can and has been absolutely proved, and you can have that information right in your own hands. You can study it. You can teach it in plain, simple terms to your own children. You can give honest, straightforward, fearless answers to anyone who asks you, and you can understand it for yourself. God does exist. It is not a mystery that you can't understand. It is scientifically, absolutely, infallibly demonstrated and stands proved. And now I'm going to give you, right here and now on this program, as quickly as I can and yet as thoroughly as I can in the remaining time, 7 proofs that God does exist. You're living in one of the most frightful decades in all of history, a time when it has never been more urgently necessary to understand the question, does God exist? We're faced with the threat of nuclear annihilation. We're living in a world that is a veritable jungle, a veritable chaotic mess of conflicting ideologies, of conflicting opinions, of conflicting governmental isms, and then conflicting and chaotic divisions in religion. And today, atheists, many scientists, historical geologists, or paleontologists and others assume that God doesn't exist. Communism teaches God does not exist. Churchgoers, on the other hand, Christians assume that he does, but has either side ever gone out of their way to prove it? Have you ever seen the proof one way or the other? It's time you began to quit assuming. It's time you saw the proof. You know, there's one delusion that grips more minds of people today than that of communism. It holds them in its grip, in its sway, like slaves, deluding, blinding, deceiving them, making them veritable slaves, and that is the concept of no God. Now, recently, a very famous evolutionist, who is the grandson of the famous evolutionist Sir Huxley, whose tomb I have seen over in England, said the following. He said, and I quote, there is no longer either need or room for supernatural beings capable of affecting the course of events in the evolutionary pattern of thought, end of quotation. He went on to say the earth was not created, it evolved. Today, in our modern scientific endeavor and the place to which our knowledge has developed, we can now dispense with any pagan, ancient, mythological idea of the existence of a God. And so today, people are being told that the existence of God was merely an excuse that ancient Hebrew parents gave to their children. And they said, Daddy, who made all this? They said, well, God made it, son. And since they didn't have at their disposal all the so-called tools of science, such as we're supposed to have today, that was their excuse. Well, my friends, can we dismiss it that easily? Can we dismiss the statements in the Bible that says, I am God, and there is none beside me? I hold all nations as less than nothing in my sight, as a drop in a bucket. I've created the heavens and the earth, the universe, every law, every force, every energy. I created man and put him on this earth. I created every kind of life, flora, fauna, the plant life, every mineral, every element, every law that governs these things. This vast, almost incomprehensible, interdependent species or series of life forms on this earth I have created and set in motion. I've done all this. I hold it in the palm of my hand. I am its protector, its provider, its originator, its designer, its sustainer. I am the one who is going to intervene in the course of life here below, and I am the one who is going to alter the very course of the history of man. Now, you know, God makes these and other claims in the first person in the Bible. There is a being speaking in these terms. You know, you need to find out whether or not those things are true, whether or not there is a God, whether or not he really has that power. Now, is there really no longer any need for some kind of a concept of God? Is the Bible really a collection of Hebrew fables? Now, these questions demand an answer. Your life, the lives of your loved ones, your very environment, your own society hinges on the answer to this question and hangs in the balance. So, listen carefully, jot down the primary proofs, and then be sure to write in for the article and booklets I will announce. Here, then, is, right here and now, proof number 1. Proof number one that God does exist. Now, first of all, I want to give you a little bit of analytical explanation of the very beginning things that are always presented to the average layman in the historical geological books, in the books on geology and science, and even books that are put in the hands of children. I was paging through one just the other day in a very large department store on the story of man and the way it is first in colorful and artistic form presented to little children about ancient cavemen and the concepts as to the beginning of the universe. Now, do Christians have to be afraid or apprehensive of science textbooks? Is the Bible totally out of harmony with all science? Is science foreign and opposed to the Bible? First of all, let me give you an idea from a typical college textbook from which I'm going to quote briefly, which does discard the Bible record. Here is a typical explanation in the forward material of the ideas of the authors as to the origin of the Earth. I quote, "Our own galaxy, which we remember is but a tiny part of the universe, has probably existed a million, million years. But some progress has been made in attempting to explain how and when the sun and its nine planets came into being. The study of the solar system," went on these authors, "gives us at least a clue to the origin of that part of the universe most important to us, the Earth. The explanation," it went on, "commonly accepted today, is called the hypothesis of dynamic encounter, formulated about 1900 by a couple of men who were mentioned here. In brief, it suggests that our solar system had its birth when the sun was approached by another huge star. The latter, through the operation of the law of gravitation, detached from the sun great masses of flaming gas. The orphan masses," it went on, "from the parent sun gradually cooled and crystallized to become the nuclei of planets." So says this hypothesis of dynamic encounter, formulated way back about 1900. Now, it went on to say that these continued to revolve around the sun, held in their orbit by the gravitational pull of the parent body. Now, the evolution of the Earth, it finally concluded, to its present state was very gradual. Now, you'll notice that's a definite past tense. First of all, we had different statements about possibly, perhaps, and so on. Now, I quoted this statement in full and took time for it for a special reason. So let's go back and carefully analyze what we have just heard. Now, notice real carefully some of the words you just heard. I want to repeat them. We've heard these words in the opening phrases of this science book. Probably. Some progress has been made. We heard attempting to explain. We heard at least a clue. We heard the word explanation commonly accepted. We heard the word hypothesis. We heard the word, in brief, it suggests. Well, now, what a collection is this? Ideas, probabilities, perhapses, maybes, clues, suggestions, and hypotheses. And then finally, all of a sudden, we have the definite statement that the evolution of the Earth to its present state was very gradual. Past tense, that's the end of it. It's over with. From there on, you don't assume, guess, or have a hypothesis anymore. Now you've got definite past statements of what did happen. Well, now let's analyze it a little further. Let's go to the very trunk of the tree of this very vital first proof, then, of the existence of God. Notice that at the very beginning of all of these textbooks, all of the writers begin with what? They begin with a huge sun. They begin with a fantastically gigantic star. They begin with the operation of the law of gravitation. You heard it quoted. They begin with great, quote, masses of flaming gas, end of quote. They begin by admitting that these gases, quote, gradually cooled, end of quotation. They talk about the approach of one great, huge astral body to another. They talk about these astral bodies continuing to, quote, revolve around the sun, held in their orbits by the gravitational pull of the parent body, end of quotation. Well, what a fantastic array. What a beginning. Here is a limitless, fantastic, tremendous, imagination-defying expanse. An entire universe, we see. Here is a whole solar system, a huge sun, the operation of definite, immutable, unchangeable laws. Here is a supposed collision, which collision, remember, is the result of huge forces and is a result of law. Here, then, is a supposed collision between gigantic, breathtaking, huge astral bodies resulting in the supposed formulation of this present solar system. Then think. Think for a moment. Where do we go to the trunk of the tree? What is the precept and the principle behind all of this? Here is the existence of a universe, every single bit of it, going according to law. You begin to comprehend? By what law did one great star approach another? By what law? What made heat gradually cool? By what law did a gravitational pull exist? What law was it that made these so-called split-off pieces begin to revolve around the sun? By what law was there in existence the operation of the law of gravitation? You see, there was a good bit left out in these opening words in the quotations of the science book. They began with a gigantic, imagination-defying, limitless creation. They began with a creation which was orderly, systematic, and was going according to laws. Well, there it is. Now, in dissecting and looking carefully into the statements of some of the preposterous hypotheses which have been advanced, you begin to see that in every case the writers have begun with an orderly, law-abiding universe governed by irrefutable laws. The existence of law, then, demands a lawgiver. James 4 and verse 12 in your New Testament says, there is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. James 4 and verse 12. First proof, then, is the existence of laws demands a lawgiver. That's such a tremendous subject I couldn't even begin to scratch the surface on this one program. Now, that is the lengthiest of all the proofs, and I've taken more time with it. So let's hurry along. Proof number two. Let's come to understand that today you look around you and you are aware of the existence of life. One of the greatest proofs in all of science, one of the greatest laws in all of science, is the law of biogenesis, that life comes only from life. That is, that bio means life, genesis means beginning. This law, then, is a law concerning or about the beginning of life. It is simply stated the absolute law that life comes from life. Proof number two of the existence of God is this. There is life on this earth, interdependent life, life which reproduces after its own kind. That life never comes from the not living, but only from pre-existing life. That is an absolute law. Life demands a life giver. Law demands a lawgiver. Proof number one, a lawgiver. Proof number two, a life giver. What is the third proof? To a great degree, every single one of these proofs definitely overlap. Well, today you see a great universe that is in motion. You see all these life creatures, the cyclical pattern of life, everything not living or dying to itself, but living or dying to every other thing. And the world and the earth and all life thereupon it is self-sustaining, that is, of course, by its own orderly, interdependent life forms that live upon it. Now, recently, scientists used to talk about the conservation of matter, but now with the advent of the radioactivity, or the discoveries of it, and the nuclear physicists, and all of their theories and discoveries, with the advent, of course, of the discovery of radium, and finally, in our space and nuclear age of today, we have seen that there is definitely a deterioration of matter, that uranium, U-238, gradually disintegrates through many intermediate stages into lead. So we know that, basically, let's put it this way, the Earth and the universe is like a great giant clock. It is gradually running down. There is no new uranium coming into existence, and yet all uranium is gradually giving off energy in the form of radioactivity and is gradually disintegrating into lead. It's a very almost seemingly limitless period of time it is involving many, many multiple thousands of years, but it is a fact. This means, simply stated, that science, not religious man, but science, has proved that the Earth is gradually running down. It's been gradually running down for many, many years. You can see that in the erosion of the leveling of high places, making it into lower places, the gradual filling of the ocean bottoms and the raising of the sea levels. You can see it in the gradual melting of the polar caps and so on and so on. What does that prove? It proves exactly this, that the proof number three is this. It had to be at one time or another wound up. It had to be at one time or another begun. It had to be established. It had to have a beginning. It had to be created. In other words, creation did not always exist. Simply stated, proof number three is this, that creation demands a creator. This creation we're able to see, weigh, measure, and observe, and we're able to travel in which we're living, our very environment, is firmly established by the laws of science to have been begun. That is, that there has been, and let me just put it this way, no past eternity of matter. Matter must, at one time or another, come into existence. Creation, then, the very existence of things, is an absolute demonstrable proof of the existence of God. Proof number one, law demands a lawgiver. Proof number two, life demands a life giver. Proof number three, creation demands a creator. Proof number four, let's go into that one right quickly. Right now we see that life does reproduce. It does produce life, but it also reproduces life of the same kind. You cannot jump the gap between kind. There is a book by Mr. Nelson, After His Kind. That is the title of it. Now, very briefly, let me just tell you this. God is quoted in the Bible as saying, "Let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, the beast of the earth after his kind." Read Genesis 1, verses 24 and 25. Scientists then in so-called comparative embryology have tried to prove by a study of selective breeding, genetics, and various other aspects of biology that there is an evolutionary pattern. What they have been able to prove is simply this, that the embryo of a fish, of a polywog, or of a man may look exactly like each other in a certain stage or a phase. But I defy scientists to try to make one turn into the other. Comparative embryology means simply this, that certain embryos look alike. That's all it means. You cannot make a polywog turn into anything other than a frog. You cannot make the embryo of a little chicken turn into anything other than a chicken. You can't make the embryo turn into anything other than a fetus and finally a human being, if that is the kind of embryo that you are observing. Comparative embryology tries to point out that the beginning embryos of these various life forms look exactly alike. That is absolutely true, but it proves nothing for the case of evolution, but it does offer a stronger proof of the existence of God, and that is that kind reproduces after kind. Simply stated, what is this proof? It is this, that all of these laws are kept alive, and they are sustained. The sustaining, then, the continuing of the operation of these laws demands a sustainer. How? That sustainer is God. Your Bible says that God keeps this universe moving, that he keeps the life existing on it and everything functioning just the way it should by his sustaining power. So kind after kind, or in other words, the sustaining of life demands the existence of a sustainer. Proof number one, laws demand a lawgiver. Proof number two, the existence of life demands a life giver. Proof number three, the very creation demands a creator. And now the fourth proof, that which is being sustained and kept going demands a sustainer. Proof number five, let's look at it. It is a world of great design. You've never seen an ugly sunset. You've never seen any kind of a mineral that is in itself ugly. You've never seen anything in nature that is not capable and does not evidence great and tremendous design. Did all the flowers, the herbs, the grasses, the trees, the grains, the bees, the birds, all the plant and animal life, everything, the myriads of different life forms on this earth evolve slowly and gradually over the ages? Why, these are totally insurmountable, unanswerable questions to the evolutionists. It is better that we just take it out and look at it for a moment. This great universe, I've got to hurry to give them to you, but you can write in for a little better and more thorough proof in written form. This great universe, this complex, intricate earth on which you live and draw breath, is a world of great design. You can smash certain minerals, and you cannot make them break in any other way but the exact way in which they will always break. That is true of many different minerals. They have cleavage and scratch properties you need to study into it and to find. About the properties of minerals, the wings of a bird, a fly, the beauty of a sunset, the facets of a quartz crystal, and above all, the great, marvelous, tremendous masterpiece of all design, the human body and the human mind, there had to be a designer. Proof number five is there is great design, and for the design, there had to be a designer. Isn't it amazing that the feathers of a bird and the trunk and branches of a tree are very similar? There was an overall pattern. There was design. There had to be a designer. So that is proof number five. Proof number six. is fulfilled prophecy. You need to write for our booklet to get that proof on the proof of the Bible. And that is that there are dozens, hundreds, yes, even thousands of minute technical and then many large, great, overwhelming prophecies which have been described in intricate detail, and they have been fulfilled. Fulfilled prophecy, which has accurately, infallibly come to pass, is proof number 6. It is a definite proof of the existence of God. Write for our booklet on that, the proof of the Bible. Proof number 7, the final proof of all, is the one, of course, that is a proof only to Christians. It is a proof that atheists, agnostics, and scientists would always doubt, because it is the proof of answered prayer. Because, you see, an atheist, an agnostic, or a scientist has never prayed. And if he has, he certainly never prayed in real belief, thinking he's going to get an answer. Well, you know, George Mueller was an example who prayed. He was certainly a modern apostle of faith in that one thing. He certainly believed in it. For about 70 years, he continued a work which began as a result of believing prayer. Altogether, as a result of believing prayer, he received £1,400,000. That was about $7 million of dollars in that day's exchange rate. And that was all sent to him for the conduct of a certain work in orphanages and so on as a result of believing prayer. Now, you know, real answered prayer is not a mere working out of events as a result of concentration. It is not a mere series of circumstances. It is not mere coincidence. It is the dynamic, supernatural intervention, the completely miraculous intervention and direct answer from Almighty God. It's the result of being obedient to God's laws. It's the result of going to Him earnestly, fervently, and beseechingly on your knees in believing prayer and having those prayers answered. I have had many prayers answered. My father has had many hundreds and hundreds of prayers answered. And I mean sometimes absolutely immediately and in tangible, definite, provable form. Well, that's the seventh and the final proof. Perhaps it's one of the major ones, and yet it is one that would be denied by those who have never prayed. Well, is it possible then to prove there is a God? You know, one writer in a newspaper was asked that question. It appeared recently in a clipping. A young man in the city approached the desk of a librarian and said this to the librarian, "I would like to borrow a book that proves there is a God. Some of the fellows doubt it. I want to get the proof." So the clipping said, "It's easy to understand the lad's problem. But when he is a little older, he will discover that there is no such book written as the one he asked for. We do not prove God by mathematical processes. Instead, we come upon him as a personal experience. It is just a little like falling in love. We cannot describe it, and we cannot define it." Well, now, that clipping was in error. It said there is no such book written as the one he asked for, and that is, where is the proof about the existence of God? Yes, there is, too, a book written about that. We've got it for you. Free of charge, by return mail, no price whatsoever, and that is the booklet on Does God Exist? And also, if you want this program in written form, this program which you have just heard, then write for this amazing article, 7 Proofs God Exists. It's free of charge, no price. You can have it by return mail. The booklet, Does God Exist? The article, 7 Proofs God Exists. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. All you need to do is to list the callers of your station and send your name and address to the address which will follow again in just a moment. And so until this same hour, same station, 1 week from now, or until tomorrow and daily over most of these stations, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.